smoke a cigarette. Yeah, let me check in with my brother, and I'll be right back.
Rasheen, ain't you supposed to be at work? You just started the job. You just started the job. All
right.
You know what I'm saying?
You supposed to be at work.
Hey, Rasheen, is Vega out? Okay. Mo has a thing. They can't come in there.
Oh, somebody took
one.
Oh, my. Hey, Alyssa. Perfect. It doesn't matter.
I mean, they still mad about him going outside.
All right.
Now, I told him not to go outside that night.
Good afternoon. All right, I don't care to hear you. Good afternoon. All right. How many of y'all were just at the celebration? Great. Well, thank you so much for being here, for bringing all of that beautiful energy from that space into here. And I'm really excited to see how this is all going to mix together. And I hope we all walk away with some more wisdom and some good challenges. All right, so Alandria is going to take us away.
Oh, okay. Get out.
Whatever. How you doing, everybody? All righty. So if people can move to the front. Move to the front. I'm talking out of a different church experience, and then came UU. So you need to move to the front.
Make friends with your neighbor.
Make friends with your neighbor. You don't need to say hi. That may take an hour. But, so I come from the South, and so we at least start everything in song. And so I'm trying to think.
They know this little bit of mine.
Great. They just sang it.
They did?
They did. Okay, so here we go. We're going to do another song that people may not know, but I love a lot. Mm-hmm. All right, so it goes like this. Solid as a rock.
Solid as a rock.
Rooted as a tree.
Rooted as a tree.
We are here.
We are here.
Standing strong.
Standing strong.
In our rightful place.
In our rightful place.
All right. Solid as a rock, more time.
Solid as a rock.
Rooted as a tree.
Rooted as a tree.
We are here.
We are here.
Standing strong.
Standing strong.
In our rightful place.
In our rightful place.
I don't have the best singing voice. There's a lady I love a lot named Tafar Walla Muhammad, who always says it doesn't matter if you can sing well or on key, just sing together, we can make revolution happen. So are we ready? All righty. Solid as a rock.
Solid as a rock.
We are rooted as a tree.
We are rooted as a tree.
We are here.
We are here.
Standing strong.
Standing strong.
In our rightful place.
In our rightful place.
We are solid as a rock.
Solid as a rock.
We are rooted as a tree.
We are rooted as a tree.
We are here.
We are here.
Standing strong.
Standing strong.
In my rightful place.
In our rightful
place. In our rightful place. In our rightful place. So if you ever see a movie called Capitalism, a Love Story, in the Miami piece, my young folk with the Miami Worker Center, Empower You, are stopping homes from being taken away. And in that piece, they're singing that song, right? So there's a power of song and organizing work. It's not just about sounding good. It's about actually movement building. So welcome to this workshop. I hope you know what you're here for. And I wanted to do a little bit of context around why we wanted to do this. Some of the people I've known on this thing for a very long time, especially this one right here. Other people we've known various periods of time. But all of us act out of our faith in the work we do. And it was really important because a lot of times when we talk about what this work means to us and why Black Lives Matter and why movement work matters, sometimes we're able to talk about it from a theological perspective and rooted in our faith and in our gut. And other times we're like, oh, I do it because it might matter. If it impacts you directly, you're able to do it because I do it, because if I don't do it, I'm gonna die. But if that's not your reality, then sometimes we don't know from which our root comes from. And so we wanted to ground the conversation in, what does it mean to do this work theologically? And what does it mean for some of us who don't have reverence in front our name, to do this work not because we're ministers, but to do this work and how we do our organizing work in community. So sometimes when we come to UU conferences, it becomes a, you either are a minister and you do this in a church, or you're doing, or you're a community organizer and you do it that way. We wanted to bring in people who do both organizing work, that's all what we do is our organizing work, and we do work out of our faith. Does that make sense? Okay. And so it was important to have people that have also done work for long periods of time on different issues so that we could connect, because right now what's happening, and people talked about this some this morning, is that Black Lives Matter is being placed in a vacuum. Like, I wasn't dealing with people trying to harass me with police when I was 15. I'm 35. That was 20 years ago. Like, I don't go to Palestine and Israel and understand, as I meet Lisa again in Palestine, why Palestine matters in this conversation, right? And so how we, in this one too, right? But how we are in this moment connected to a long movement trajectory and a long struggle for change. And as Obama leads people in Amazing Grace at the same church that Denmark Bessie was a member of, what is the history of struggle we are a part of? And so nothing is about a theme and nothing's about a moment. It's about a period of time and struggle. And that through that struggle comes a different way we live out our faith, and we live out our lives. Mm-hmm. And so we really wanted to put on a piece that also helped people understand all of our pieces of work and how we all intersect, while also really grounding in this moment we're in, and also holding that, yes, we had a great victory today, and TPP was passed,
right,
which is not a good thing at all.
Right.
Same person pushed both things.
Right.
So if we don't understand that TPP is just as relevant, and if we lift up victories yesterday, but we didn't talk about what it meant for the Fair Housing Act,
amen,
how do all these things relate, we will get completely lost and blinded. So that is the other reason we wanted to do this, is for us to understand how things relate to each other. So I implore my folk up here to talk both about what's happening in your life now and how that reflects the work you've been doing forever and a day and from which you come.
So we're gonna start by going down the panel with a short bio from each person. And each person's gonna start off with answering the question, how does your work around the movement for Black lives connect to liberation struggles you have been and are involved with for the long haul? And then we're gonna have Reverend Sekou speak. Yes, definitely say our names. Oh. Okay, I guess I'll start. All right. Smooth transitions. So my name is Alyssa Goss. I'm 25 years old. I live in Seattle. I work with the Washington Student Association. So we do higher education, lobbying, and most importantly, campus organizing and mobilization of students. I also was really involved with Students for Justice in Palestine when I was a student at the Evergreen State College, and was a member of the Olympia Unitarian Universalist Church, and I have some wonderful members of that community here who are really important to my faith development as a young activist. And so how I guess I would answer the question is, for me, it comes from my place of privilege. You know, the choice to become a Unitarian Universalist, you know, as an American citizen, as a white female, as a cisgendered female, that moment of realizing that, you know, if oppression's like a river, you know, it flows one way, and I've been going downstream. And so it's so important, I've come to realize, especially through my faith, how important it is to fight upstream and to turn around and make the choice to turn around and work upstream, even though it's so easy to just kind of hope that I'm just going to cross my fingers that everything works out if I just keep swimming downstream. But that's not the reality we live in. And so that's what got me connected to doing work around anti-racism as a white person and doing self-work and how critical that is if we're going to be in beloved community, that I'm constantly challenging myself and working on how to challenge others. And then same with Palestine as a U.S. citizen, how critical it is that we understand our role in that occupation as taxpayers, as funding the Israeli military, and also learning how do we hold beloved community in discussing this issue, and as understanding our shared histories and the histories we don't share, and showing up for that.
I'm Amy Santos Lyons. I'm a community organizer and director of programs at Western State Center. It's based here in Portland, Oregon, and we do regional social justice movement building. And I was born and raised in the Philippines. I'm a martial law baby. So I grew up really in the shadows of the Marcos dictatorship. As a high school student, I saw the fall and the toppling of that dictatorship. And then as a student in the university, I was part of the campaign to evict the US military bases. And then was a community organizer with many of the urban poor communities working with women and young folks for land security, reproductive health, and domestic violence. And when I immigrated 15 years ago to the US, the moment I stepped here, I became a person of color. And it's taken me all this time, and I'm an ongoing student of the racial justice history and movement here in the United States. And I think in the work that I've done in reproductive health rights and justice, at the core of those movements is the bedrock idea of body sovereignty and self-determination and the ways we lift up the lives and the leadership of the people most affected and most vulnerable. And so I think in the ways that I can provide my talent, my time, and my energy to help as a non-black person, right, understand the ways that I am complicit to the violence on black folks, and to help name the unspeakable, the unacceptable, and then also make sure that we are disrupting and transforming that machine.
Hey friends, my name is Kenny Wiley, and I am a senior editor for UU World Magazine, and I also work as the director of faith formation at Prairie UU Church near Denver, Colorado. So, I wonder if I'm the only one in here, I bet so. I am a third generation black UU from the South. Anyone else? So my dad's mom, my grandmother, she wandered into a Unitarian church in Arkansas in the 60s, and she, yeah, and she's like, well, there's a lot of white people, but it's all right, so, you know, and my dad started going with her in the early 70s, and I'm a lifelong UU myself, so. What is fascinating when I think about this question of the liberation struggles you have been and are involved with. So my family, my grandmother was part of the first class of black women to get a doctorate from the University of Arkansas. My dad was a lawyer. My mom was a lawyer, and you know, I've been very comfortable. And I grew up UU and in the suburbs, which means like that's a lot of white people. And that was my life, and you can lose something. And I felt growing up that I was missing something. And you know, even being instilled with these values, these wonderful principles that we celebrate and embrace, things felt empty. And so for a long time, you know, I see a lot of my friends in the crowd, and they've seen me on varying points in this journey. It's to be a proud UU and also a proud black person. And for me, one big move on that journey was in August when Mike Brown was killed. You know, I'd been moved by hearing. I remember as I was, just so you know, I'm 27, and so I was 7 maybe. O.J. Simpson. I was a toddler. Rodney King. But like I was aware of these things. I mean, my parents' friends. We were talking about these things, and it's been this long journey of engaging with my blackness, that realizing not only that I couldn't hide, but that I didn't want to hide who I was. And what has happened now is that I am an activist. When this time, the last year, I wouldn't have said that. That I felt moved that just because of economic comfort and educational privilege, that didn't mean that because my family had made it, that therefore my work was done. And that's why I'm here. That's why I've been in the streets of Denver, in meeting rooms in Denver, at the State House, all of these things. Because, depending on what time of night is, if I don't have lots of my white buddies around, like I'm just some black dude walking down the street. But not only that, it doesn't matter how I sound, it doesn't matter how you sound, respectability politics won't save me and it won't save black folks. And so,
say it, son, say it.
So the truth is, I think I got more work to do and I think we all do, so that's why I'm here, because my journey is of embracing this beautiful burden that has been placed upon me because of my black skin and because of my black heritage. Thanks. My dad is from Bill Clinton's hometown, a place called Hope, yes. Hope, Arkansas.
My name is Chris Crass. And it's really beautiful to just share this space with the folks on this panel and hear. I mean, the time that we're in and the people's movements that are rising up, it was people's movements that really brought me into the work that I do. I was already an activist, but the Rodney King verdict, I live 30 minutes from the white middle-class suburb that had the verdict, and I live 30 minutes from the multiracial working-class city of Los Angeles that rose up in rebellion. And that rising up of rebellion, just like in Ferguson, helped to make history that transformed consciousness for a whole lot of people. And I was one of those people who went from the awkward, colorblind, I'm trying to be a good white person, to realizing that a good white person is just like a good German who is supporting a supremacy system and a supremacy structure that is annihilating people's lives. And I didn't want to be a good German. I didn't want to be a good white person. I wanted to be a part of the long legacy of white anti-racists who responded to the call in the civil rights movement for folks after Freedom Summer. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee called for white folks to go back into white communities, create freedom schools in white suburbs, to free white young people's minds from the grips of white supremacy, and that we needed to build a base of conscious, active, equipped, courageous white people for racial justice to form the multiracial movements that could transform the society. And so my journey, my spiritual practice, my heart, my soul, my grief, my rage, my love is tied up in trying to help free other white people's minds from the death culture of white supremacy and try to pull this poison out of us so we can join in an accountable, in faith, in love, in multiracial movements like the Black Lives Matter movement with black leadership at the center. This is a historic time to try to rip off the death culture that is killing all of us. And so for myself as a white person, my spirituality, my call is to try to answer the call of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and so many black leaders throughout history who have called on white folks to step up in a way that respects the leadership of folks of color and black leadership in particular, but is also calling white people to also bring leadership in white society, to create a different kind of white leadership that isn't the racist leadership, but is an anti-racist white leadership that is courageously giving young white people like my four-year-old son a sense of possibility of what he could be one day in a multiracial movement for a beloved community world. So that's my journey and that's my work.
Oh, this is so weird because you can't see me. People over there can't actually see me, can you?
No.
Okay, so I'm Landry Williams again. I'm from Knoxville, Tennessee. So my name's Landry Williams. I can get louder than this, don't worry. My name's Landry Williams. I'm from Knoxville, Tennessee. My whole family is from the Gulf Coast and the South. And so for me, I rep that really, really hard, and that's in my body, blood, and bones. And I got started on this liberation journey a long time ago. With people who fought in every single way. My parents are here, so I actually grew up UU, but went to Mount Zion Baptist Church in Knoxville, Tennessee first, and then became a Unitarian Universalist. But my parents are here running around. But, you know, you get stuff in the blood, right? So my grandfather refused to give in. My dad's family, like, ran away from slavery and got their own land. They were Tuskegee Airmen. My mom was on the Edmund Pettus Bridge twice. My dad was in SNCC. They were involved, engaged, activist people who raised me to understand the world differently, who raised me to be a Pan-Africanist and to understand where I sit and where I'm supposed to be. And so I got involved in an organization where I work, so I'll talk about some of that, called the Highlander Research and Education Center, which is based out of Tennessee, which is why I still live near my house. And I got started at seven and then got it started at 14, getting rid of Confederate flags from my high school. And when the police surrounded us doing work, because it had just happened. So when all this stuff was happening around Rodney King, it was also happening where I live and people getting shot. Yeah. And so when I was 14, I was sexually assaulted. A friend of mine was shot and killed, and we had to do organizing work. And so we started a Citizens Police Review Board in Knoxville, Tennessee, and I was 15 years old helping start it. And so I think what's really important to me is that it's not about age, right? Some of the greatest changes ever happened has happened by 14, 15, 16, and 17-year-olds putting their bodies on the line and not caring. And so when I think about my experiences as a Unitarian Universalist, is also being doing the same. And so not actually worrying about whatever kind of job or whatever, but saying actually, nah, this is the line in the sand, and you either stand for something or you don't. And I think that's, to me, is what's been really important and essential. It's also fighting for things that don't seem like they're related and saying, how do we make that move happen? So I'm not going to talk much longer. If anyone else wants to know my story, I'm happy to share. It gets really long. Because I actually want you to hear Sekou speak, because he flew a long way to be here. And I'll be around all week.
Let me begin by saying thank you to the folks who coordinated me getting here. And it's good to see so many of my friends. Can you hear me now? And so I want to just say thank you to the folks who coordinated me getting here, and Sister Lisa, who's been working with our staff to make sure I arrived on time. We had a little scare this morning, but we got here. And then I have known Elandria for 20 years. And I remember being in meetings at Highlander going, who is this crazy little kid? And she actually knows what she's talking about. And so I just wanted to say thank you to her. And I'm essentially here because she told me to be here. I actually didn't really know what the workshop was until she just said what it was. And so, but if she tells me to be somewhere, I'm going to be there. And then Brother Chris Crass, who I've been privileged to struggle alongside for a very long time, it is deeply just a blessing to be in the same room with you. I think he is the most significant anti-racist white brother in the country. And to my fellow panelists, I want to say thank you. Brother Wiley, you from Arkansas.
I'm from Texas.
You from Texas. Your daddy from Arkansas. So is this one better? Well, can I keep my hands free? It don't work. We're gonna work this out. This don't count for none of my time either.
No.
I'm third generation Pentecostal. So I shall attempt to be uncharacteristically brief. And so I come from a tradition, if you talk back to me, you know, a little amen here and there, that might help me along. And then I wanna say, is that Sister Bettini back there from Metropolitan Congregations United? I have been in the street with her many a day and shared way too much tear gas. And I want to say thank you to her and Brother Rasheen, who's been one of the definitive youth leaders to emerge out of our work. And I'm glad to see him and Reverend Julie, who we have walked many a mile with our hands up with machine guns pointed at us. And Sister Archene, a great Unitarian who I've known from D.C. a very long time. And then my dear brother, Bishop John Selders, who just got out of jail. I think you were in jail last week, was it? For the work that they've been doing with Connecticut More Mondays. And then lastly, Sister Lissa, we went to Union together, who's just been appointed, I think, the senior pastor of Visit First Unitarian in Pasadena, California. And so I'm so happy to see her. And so it's a bit of a coming home. And where are you at, Deb from the Religious Institute, who has done quite a bit to ensure that I get excommunicated because of my position on a woman's right to choose. And so thank you. So y'all hold a little room for me in the UUs. I may have to come over and see you when they get done with me. But I think our task this morning, this evening, is to talk a little bit about how our faith has come to impact the ways in which we engage in social movement work. So let me engage in something that is deeply un-Unitarian. Let me begin on a Christological note. And so I want to begin with this question of who is the person of Jesus? Because if you tell me what you know about Jesus, I can tell you what you know about Ferguson. And so let us begin with the history of Christian orthodoxy. And the history of Christian orthodoxy is such that there's never debate whether or not Jesus was divine. The church fathers, and let us be clear that they were fathers. We don't say this as an abstract. That a group of men got in a room together and decided that Jesus was always divine. And so let us begin with that undisputed orthodoxy in Christianity that Jesus was always divine. And so part of the orthodoxy of Christianity is God chose to become flesh in the body of an unwed teenage mother among an unimportant people in an unimportant part of the world living under occupation. Now, this is the orthodoxy of Christianity, and that it has stood two millennia as a consideration of the ways in which we orientate ourselves as Christian creatures. So what does it mean that if God, the one who we highly Christocentric and highly religious folks sing, particularly those of us who are Pentecostal, and if you may allow me to engage in a kind of Pentecostal hermeneutic of suspicion, preoccupied with signs and wonders, and that God is still speaking in terms of democratic language in which all can hear. And so what does it mean that God enters into the world in the body of an unwed teenage mother among an unimportant people and an unimportant part of the world living under occupation, and that the translation of him being a carpenter is an inappropriate translation? It's actually, he was a handyman. The accurate translation is that he who works with his hands. So what does it mean that the very savior of the world is a handyman? Handyman. One who we sing praises, oh come let us adore us. He alone is worthy. That God is a handyman. You know him. He comes by your house in the winter and says he'll sweep off your porch for $2 or $3. The jack of all trade, the master of none. That what does it mean if Christianity begins its moment as this being the creature, and that this becomes a way in which we orientate ourselves theologically? And again, while I have been trained by the best of the liberation theologians, particularly that of James Cone, I am not making an argument for liberation theology. I'm making a claim that is essential to the heart of the biblical narrative, that Jesus was an oppressed person, a Palestinian living under occupation. And if we claim to follow this particular creature, what is our moral and ethical responsibility to Ferguson, to Baltimore, to Charleston? What does it mean at this particular moment in which black bodies are subject to the arbitrary violence of the state every other day in America? Some mother is setting up a makeshift memorial in a place that we have never heard of, some obscure street corner that shall be known in infamy by virtue of the fact that these mothers shall lay candles, and they said lay baseball caps and teddy bears to sanctify the blood of their children.
Yep.
And that part and parcel of understanding the connection between our struggle has to do with the ways in which we are in a moment which shall be perhaps known as the last days, the very decline of the American empire, that the American empire is falling, and we see the fall connected to the global collapse of 2008 where 40 million people go into poverty worldwide overnight and not one banker been to jail. But you get mad and you take these young people like Racine and other and try to give them felony charges and give young people who have engaged in forms of rebellion, which includes the destruction of property, you try to give them cases for stealing some sneakers. But when people have stolen the entire livelihood of 40 million people and not one of them go to jail.
Right.
So we are in a moment that is connected to the global collapse of the economy, in which we see that Ferguson and Baltimore and the rebellions that we've seen look a lot more like an intifada than they do the civil rights movement.
Yep.
Because what we have seen is that when we see those images coming out of Baltimore, young people standing in front of the police when they've been cordoned off, they've been kettled, which is a violation of the UN and their human rights. They've been kettled, and the police tell them that they can't go home, and they begin to throw rocks at the police. It looks like Palestine. And it looks like Palestine because the very police chiefs who are operating in these various cities were trained in Israel. And so I saw when I was in Ferguson, when I looked at Ferguson standing in the street, I fundamentally felt in my body the same way I felt when I was in Palestine. Because the police chief were running Israeli tactics on black babies in America. And it was the Palestinians who tweeted us and told us how to deal with tear gas. Yep. Over 250 Palestinians marched with us in the streets of Ferguson. We have always been clear in our unequivocal support in Ferguson of our solidarity with the Palestinian struggle, because when I was in Palestine, I understood one thing. In 15 minutes, I got it. I said, oh, y'all the niggas. Yep. Oh, they snatch your babies out. They criminalize you. They over-sexualize you. They don't give you access to the land of which you've been through. The part of one way to understand Palestine is the kind of form of globalized gentrification. So the Palestinian struggle becomes one way for us to understand this particular moment. And then let me close on this note. The part of our challenge is to understand that this moment won't look like what you're used to. Martin Luther King ain't coming back. And that the way this movement is going to look, it is queer, it is woman-led, it is angry, it is profane, it says fuck the police. Yeah. Yeah. And if you are more concerned about the young people saying fuck the police than the fucked up conditions that they live in, there's something wrong with you and not them. And for the white folks in the room, it's a few of y'all. The part of this obsession in postmodern, which is obsessed with a certain form of epistemic skepticism, whereby people don't believe in anything and everything's obsessed with certain forms of neoliberalism. And in the characterizations of neoliberalism, one of the chief characterizations is individualism. And so it's all about checking your individual privilege. It's all about the ways in which white folks feel guilty for being white. And we don't need that. We don't need allies. See, an ally can check in and check out. Well, it's not really my struggle. I need to wait on black leadership. I donated some money. And this kind of unwillingness is part of this epistemic skepticism, because people want it to be, there's sides to be chosen. There's decisions to be made. And so the great Ruby Sales says, we don't need allies, we need freedom fighters. Yeah. Because what you need to fundamentally understand, that you have as much cosmically at stake as black folks, that something happens to your soul when you fundamentally believe that you are better than other human beings, and that there's something spiritually at stake for you, and that your soul is at stake. And that soul may not necessarily be connected to an other, holy other, but it's the way in which you orientate yourself to the world. And it's not about white folks feeling guilty. I mean, there are a few things y'all should feel guilty about. I mean, like Justin Bieber. Y'all should feel real guilty about him. But y'all did okay, but and maybe non-Unitarian white folks, but clapping on 1 and 3, I really don't understand. So y'all should feel guilty about that. You know, Sister Bettini, I've been thinking about starting a national campaign. You know how they start these, you know, all these cities running around, they're going to pass laws on young people sagging their pants, you know. Right? I said, well, if we can pass a law on policing the way in which black children dress, we could pass a law about white folks dancing in public. I mean, it would just be a misdemeanor. I'm not trying to get nobody no federal time. And I just want to say this. That we've already won. And the question is, do we believe it? Do we believe that we fundamentally can change America? While gay marriage is a victory, It is not enough. Not when we are laying to rest the first of nine, killed in a revolutionary church. And again, I'm not against marriage. I did it twice. But what I am saying is that we have a moral and ethical obligation to stand in solidarity with trans people. We have a moral and ethical obligation to stand, because as the sister already pointed out, in terms of the sovereignty of body, the way in which racism works, it attempts to contain black bodies. It attempts to contain the bodies. And so it's an easy way for us to understand the containment of bodies as it relates to transgender persons for women. And we got a rough road ahead of us, but we've already won. Every time a black child says in Baltimore to the police, the most lethal empire in human history, if they ain't got nothing but some stones in their hands, they say, "We are going home." Every time a black child takes to the street in Ferguson and the police tell him to go home and they say, "Fuck you, you go home." Every time a group of Unitarians from all over the country gather and decide that they're gonna have an honest conversation about race, we've already won.
So here's what we're going to do. We're going to give the panelists 2 minutes to respond. Then we're going to come to you. Then we're going to go back to Rev. Sekou. All right? Okay. Please, everybody, hold to the 2 minutes.
Not black church.
No. Like you, 2 minutes. I.e., it's 11 o'clock. Church is out. 2 minutes. But whoever wants to go first, pick a person.
I think the question was, what led me to be engaged in liberation work, and how does it connect now with the time that we're in the movement for black lives? Like I mentioned, I was born and raised in the Philippines, a very colonized country. And so I see my life as a whole project and effort around decolonization. When I was a very young person, I got pregnant when I wasn't prepared and I hadn't planned it. And so I had an illegal abortion in a very Catholic country. And at the time, I was a very Catholic person. My mother named me Maria Amy, beloved Mary. I certainly had aspirations towards sainthood. But when I had that abortion, a lot of the messages and a lot of what I had heard from around me was that I was no longer a child of God. And I think that profound severance from both my community and from my God had me really reflect on the ways that we punish people to make the decisions of their own bodies, to determine their own lives, to have a life that is farther than their reach. And I knew that if I had continued with that pregnancy, I would not have been able to come out of the generational poverty of my family or come out of the projects that I had lived in. But then how did I come to terms with living and growing up in a country that said I did not matter because I did not believe in what was the orthodoxy in my country? And in many ways, I saw the other women, the other young folks in my communities grappling and struggling with the same questions, with the same issues, with the same lack of opportunities. And I became a community organizer. And in many of the communities that I was working with, their homes were being demolished by bulldozers. And I remember the very first rally I was at was to link arms with young women, old women, children, to face off a bulldozer that was about to demolish their village. And I was peeing in my pants because I was so afraid. And I picked up a rock because I was going to throw it at the driver, afraid also for my life, but afraid for all the people around me. And this elderly woman came to me and said, and took the rock from my hand and said, "We will stop them with our courage." And I think from that moment on, she had me. I was in it for life. And as I've immigrated and continued my work around reproductive health and reproductive rights and reproductive justice, the profound impact that my communities have tried to do is to also lift up the lives and the leadership of women of color, because we are not the messenger for most of those messages. And I think as I've interfaced and worked with many communities of color to again talk about our stories around reproductive health and autonomy, that space is so absent in our communities. There's so much shame, so much stigma, so much silence. And in creating that space for folks to surface those stories, stories that have been buried for 20 years, 15 years, 6 months ago, that has been a blessing for many of the organizations and communities that we work with. So I think as I see that work intersect with my struggle, my learning to become a freedom fighter, to serve the goals and the leadership of the Black Lives Matter movement, the question around courage is critical to me. How do I summon courage? How do I maintain it? How do I direct it? Again, towards liberation. And I don't have any easy answers. But I do remember that moment when we were staring and facing the bulldozer, that by our courage, we will stop them. Thank you.
As I found myself doing Black Lives Matter work into October, November, December of 2014, I found that I was moved because of my personal story and because of stories of others, but that I needed something more. And I actually found myself turning to the Unitarians and Universalists of the past, of many different races and backgrounds. What I realized I needed was I needed something like a Unitarian Universalist Black Lives Matter theology. I needed something that said, theologically, why am I here? Why are we here? And what I found was, not surprising, I guess, the first principle, the belief in the inherent worth and dignity of every person. But the truth is, we say that every Sunday or most Sundays, and it can feel kind of empty. Like, you know, it's just kind of something we say. And I started to think, especially getting Facebook messages and emails from self-identified UUs who basically told me to stop doing all this Black Lives Matter stuff. Yeah, I'll show you my inbox, it's not good. And I wondered, was the first principle a lie? But I don't think it is. I think it's kind of like our Constitution early in our country's history. And as we saw with the marriage equality ruling today, Justice Kennedy alluded to the fact that what the Constitution means can evolve over time, that what it can do for us can evolve over time. And I think about the first principle of our faith as an unrealized promise. I think of the first principle of our faith as a map of where we've been, and a map of where we can go. And when I think about this faith, I think about possibility. I think about whatever it was that allowed in the late 60s, early 70s in the South for my Black grandmother to join in. Though she was racially isolated, as many of us of color in this faith still are, that she said, even though I'm the only black Unitarian in this church or one of two, I get something here. I feel valued here. I feel safe here. And I think about my dad and my mom feeling much the same way. And I think of me feeling much the same way. And so when I look at the first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person, it's an unrealized promise. And the challenge that we're being asked to include in that first principle right now is that Black Lives Matter. Because our faith has said to people over and over and over again, whether you are a woman or gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender or depressed or angry or sad or alone, that those things can all be true and your life matters. And now we're being asked to say, Black Lives Matter. And I think if we look hard at our faith, hard at ourselves, we can fight for something and fight for black lives.
So first, I just want to say thank you for everyone being so present here in the room. I think we can all really feel it. And so what brought me to liberation work was realizing that faith can't be a statement, that it has to be a practice, and that faith is not a practice without struggle. And when it comes to doing liberation work, it means it's not, you know, just about signing a petition or saying, you know, posting a status or showing up at a march. It's about those moments when we're in the dining room with our family and they say something that's representing how they live their life. It's not just what they're saying. It's their orientation to the issue. It's their orientation to how much they actually value other lives. And I'm silent. It's those moments. You know, it's when we're in our churches and we're at our board meetings and someone brings up wanting to, you know, engage around Black Lives Matter or around, you know, Palestine, and someone says, that's too contentious, and we step back. That's when faith's a statement and not a practice. It's when we move in to those contentious moments. It's when we move in to being uncomfortable. It's when we're committed to being uncomfortable. Faith is not just feeling good. Faith can be comforting. Faith can, and it should be, and it also should be the challenge that's going to help us become more human. It's how we become more part of our members of our communities through our faith. And we can stand together and say, hey, I see where you want to be. You know, I see how much farther you want to go. Let's do this together. And so I think that's what's really helped me as a Unitarian. You know, when I went to the West Bank, I was so confused. You know, we grow up understanding, you know, the occupation in one way, and to go there and to see the occupation and how it causes so much suffering for Palestinians, the checkpoints, having their homes bulldozed, having their children shot at, and how that just doesn't get the coverage. It happens every day. Just since since the beginning of 2015, over 10 Palestinian children have been shot and killed, but there's no number on CNN that's counting. We don't hear about that. So for me, you know, with our principle, justice, equity, and compassion in all human relations, that means I can't be neutral. And that doesn't mean I have to know the answer. It doesn't mean I have to be perfect, but it means I have to struggle for that justice. It means I can't take the easy route out and say, it's too contentious, or let's listen to both sides. No, let's dive in. Yeah. Let's dive in, you know? And so through this, you know, we've been working on a curriculum with Unitarian Universalists for Justice Middle East, and that's available now. And that really came out of our desire to help all of us dive in and to struggle and to be uncomfortable So, you know, because when we host these study groups in our congregations, we're not going to leave after every session going, hey, yeah, I'm feeling good. We're going to leave going, oh, shit. You know? And when we're, you know, struggling to figure out how do I practice anti-racism? Not just how am I an ally, because we never are an ally. It's how we do it. It's that constant struggle and realizing it's not going to be perfect. There's not a 10-step list that, you know, it's not like AA. It's like, okay, well, now I'm good. You know, now I figured it out. Now I know how to live. It's the constant struggle, and that's that diving in. And I think that's what I'm inviting all of us to do as we leave here in GA is how are we going to dive into these struggles and not just fall back on being comfortable. And remember that faith is a practice.
So I grew up in a mostly white working class family. My parents were first generation middle class, second generation middle class, the majority of my family, working class white folks. And the white folks who wanted to be on the right side of history, on the side of the freedom riders, on the side of Dr. King, the white folks in my family and the white folks around me in the society who wanted to be on the right side were awkward and guilty and full of shame. And I understand why. There's a lot to feel awkward about. There's a lot to feel guilty about. There's a lot of shame. But the right-wing racists in my family could speak courageously, passionately, fiercely, angrily, and hold space and sit and feel a sense of expertise on race as they name black women on welfare for every problem in this country. And so I grew up where the people who were white who could speak about race were the racists. Where the white people who wanted to be on the right side were afraid about doing the wrong thing that kept them stuck. But I want white people to want to do the right thing and be stuck. That's a good problem to have. Now let's try to help white people not be stuck and get into motion. And so I could see in my family, as dinner table conversations would happen. It would be like these moments of experiencing all of a sudden history slowing down and like W.E.B. Du Bois' voice speaking in saying the psychological wages of white superiority are being given to working class white people in exchange for economic justice, in exchange for a sense of actually being a part of beloved community, in exchange for actually having healthy, dignified, life-affirming existence, seeing the inherent worth and dignity of all people, but instead we're given the psychological wages of superiority, which meant gutting their souls, gutting their hearts, filling them with resentment and anger and rage towards people of color. I got brought into the struggle by righteous working class, white class based anti-racist politics. My best friend at 16 named the system. He named his anger. It connected to the anger that white working class people all around me felt, but it named this economic system that pits us against each other. It named structures of oppression, and it named our coming together as key to our liberation. I want white people. My journey is that I want my 4-year-old son and my other one who's on the way in a few weeks to be born to grow up surrounded by courageous justice people, including white courageous anti-racists who have worked through the journey of guilt and shame, who have worked through the understandable awkwardness, because to be a white person, what is not awkward is to go along with white supremacy. You're on the unconscious conveyor belt of supporting a white supremacist ruling class agenda. And so when you start walking off that conveyor belt, just like you do at the airport, you're not paying attention. All of a sudden that first step off the conveyor belt can be kind of awkward. But we need white people to keep going, be awkward, and then start to find our rhythm, yeah, to be a part of multiracial movements for liberation. Yeah. And so we need courageous white people who have rage for injustice, not guilt. Yeah. Not guilt within them, because guilt within white people is poisoning us. It's poisoning white people to stay out of the movement in courageous ways. We need white people who are full of rage for what's happening in Ferguson, what's happening in Baltimore. And to realize that what's happening in Ferguson is killing. I don't want my son to grow up to be a perpetuator of racism that pulls the trigger.
I don't want any white baby to be given to white supremacy. I don't want any white child to be not given a mentor, a community of white anti-racist support, so that white children are given to the beast of white supremacy and their hearts are devoured in it. Our spiritual journey, for those of us who are white as you use, our question is not how many people of color are in our church. The question is, how much damage can our church do to white supremacy? How much? And how much can our churches, how much can our churches build towards collective liberation? Times when our faith can become a prophetic voice along with many other faiths to reclaim and ignite the heart of democratic struggle in this country. The people's movement in Ferguson reignited democratic people's struggle in this country that is alive and electric and full in this room. It is calling on us to join in collective struggle, to do all we can to work through our individual the ways that white supremacy creates binders and pits us against each other and pits us against ourselves. To join in collective struggle, and we learn so much when we're in motion for justice with other people. I can learn how to trust somebody more in 30 minutes in the streets facing off against the police than I can in 2 years being in church sitting there.
Amen. All right. So clearly, you have had good preaching. Clearly. So I'm trying to think there's anything I need to add. You don't know me, baby. So there's actually two things I do want to say. One is that it is just, yes, we have to be out in the street. So most of you don't know who I am. I've been out on the street a long time, just like most of the people in this circle. I also know we have to build institutions.
Yep.
If we don't build economic institutions, it doesn't actually matter, to be really honest. If we don't actually say what kind of economy do I want. So I do work. I organize people. I support leadership development. And every one of my young people has no job. They can facilitate the hell out of a meeting. They are damn good facilitators. They can do really good mediation training. They can train about on a whole bunch of shit. They can tear shit down. We are so good. We are ready to fight. They cannot fight to build up their own shit. And I'm saying that on purpose, because what ends up happening is then when people need to be in leadership, you end up with white people in leadership of your stuff. Because we don't know how to do our own stuff half the time. Or it looks colonialist or neoliberal or capitalist.
Yep.
And so I'm saying that because I realize, like, why am I here in this space right now? Yep. And if I'm not going to be in San Jose or Philly or Jackson for the Social Forum or for the People's Movement Assembly, and if I'm not going to be in South Carolina with my people, if I'm going to stay here, then I got to figure out what it makes sense to do while we're here. One, I need you use to move their money, to build cooperatives, to do land trusts, and to do other things that really do build up the economic power and freedom for black people, Latino people, and other peoples that actually need the assistance. We got to move the money. We got to move the money. It does not make sense just to do divestment work and not invest in something. You cannot just divest, you must invest. Our work for black lives is not just about police. Policing are an institution that was created to enforce an economic system of control. Period. That is the entire reason for existence. The military and prisons are there for enforcement. To keep the bankers in charge. To keep the 1% or the 10% or the 5 people in control. If we are not about pushing that, we are about nothing. That's A. B. if you have not spent your time in building up leadership younger than you, you have done nothing. If you do not look at your, if you do not say, I have left a job and look at the three people after me who are the people I helped train up and I now go do something else, you have not done your job. If you look at the leadership, and I'm not talking about just age, I'm talking about new. Age helps. But if you do not do leadership development and political, radical political education at every moment in your organizing work, I do not believe in the Saul Alinsky method of organizing. I am a political educator. I am a popular educator. We must do organizing and education together for radical justice. Yes. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Radical liberation.
Yes.
We as you use must use the word liberation,
yes,
as it is tattooed on my body. We can no longer talk about movements the way we do. Social action is shit. Because how we do it is very siloed. It is about this issue over here. We are going to do a witness. The witness is going to assume as if Black people, Latino people, Asian people are not impacted by economic justice or climate justice. Because we do not know how to hold everything at one time. Okay? If we cannot figure out how to hold everything at one time, we cannot win. I believe we've already, some of us have already won. Because we's moving on, well, we got to move. Everybody has not always won, because you got to feel that in here. That's in here. So I'm saying this because a lot of stuff that some of us helped create was dismantled by our faith. Uh-huh. So if we actually want to see stuff change, we have to have institutional things that help make it happen. And we have to fight for those things. So if a thing called Groundwork, which was a youth and young adult anti-racism program, gets dismantled and we let it happen and we don't put something else in its place, then we are complicit.
Yeah.
If we have all our worships talk to white people, so I want to say this because I realize there are two things that are driving me insane. I am not white, nor shall I ever have been, nor shall I ever want to be. I have been Black and happy my entire life. I have was clear in my Blackness from day one and will be to the day I die. Which means that if we are in a worship and somebody says, as white people, I will look at you and say, F you. Because you are no longer talking to me. You are talking to you. We assume, so you have, think about, I want you to listen for the rest of your time at General Assembly. Listen to the workshop leaders. Listen to the ministers. Listen to who they are actually talking to. And ask yourself, if I am not white, are you talking to me? And then you go, why are they not here? Shit, they are here. But we go and say, bump you. Let's go hang out in the hallway. Let's go get a drink. Let's go do anything. Because you're not talking to me. So we must really deal with that. The last thing I want to say, and then we're going to move on, is if we don't deal with anti-Black, I'm saying this on purpose.
Yeah.
Because the movement for Black lives is also about what anti-Black racism, yep, is about.
Yep.
Being a person of color is not actually an identity. It's a political designation.
Yep.
Designed, yep, for shifts to change. I am not a person of color. I am a Black person who also have Native ancestry. I happen to be in a people of color community to make shifts and change happen. Does that difference make sense? I am saying it because we get confused sometimes. We just get confused. And so if we're going to really organize for change, we need a strategy. See the smile? We need a strategy to do this work. It cannot be done by going to workshops. It cannot be done by reading a blog. It cannot be done by any of those things. Those things help. But if there's no strategic plan behind how we're going to make change happen, it doesn't matter. So I implore all of you to go back to where from which you came and strategically, if you don't think strategically, because we all don't, find somebody that does, and say, for all the skills and talents we have, how can we make strategic changes inside my congregation with my youth group, with my young adult group, and how can we work in partnership, and how can we work with ourselves? Because the thing that the UUs have done, if you don't know, is to really support young people who are leading in a lot of ways mm-hmm. the movement organizations in our communities. Mm-hmm. You're already there. You don't have to look for them. Mm-hmm. If you want to know who's in leadership of a lot of organizations doing social justice work, they're UUs. They were born and raised UUs, a lot of them. You just have to say, hey, come on back. Can you work with me, please? They'd be so happy. So please do the work in your local space, following the leadership of people of color, and really deal with anti-black racism. And that goes for everybody in this room, including people, me as a black person, because we all have our own journey to go.
Yeah.
So, oh, don't give me that. Okay, so the last 5 minutes gets to this man right here.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else you want to say?
So, can we get 3 or 4 questions?
Okay, come here. So here's the problem.
Okay.
Come here.
Yes, ma'am.
Because you're going to have to stay in here anyway.
Uh-huh.
So we have a time problem.
Okay.
When do you leave? So does anybody have a question?
We
get
minutes.
One. So it better be a really good one and not a commentary.
What's that?
Oh, see that knocks it down. Does anyone have one good question? All right, come on. Hurry. Okay, run back to the mic. Go to the mic. Mike. I know you can do it, though. You ain't got no heels on. Okay, we got a little time.
Okay.
Okay, so can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, well, my name is Teresa Rayford, and I'm with the local Black Lives Matter movement out here, which is Don't Shoot Portland. And everything that you guys have said, we have felt daily. It don't stop. But when we talk about strategy in the city that clouts itself as the whitest city in America and the whitest state in America, it's kind of hard because we get a lot of pushback, even when we're developing our strategies for economic development and for different legislation. We get pushback from agencies and organizations that look like us and have mission statements that say that they're supposed to support us because they feel like they're outnumbered and we're the bad guys that's gonna take away the money that they're getting right now just to stay afloat. So how do we build our revolution in a place like this that is not honoring our blackness that we're fighting for and doesn't even realize that we're fighting for the human rights and dignity of all of us? What do you tell us to do in that instance?
So a couple of things. You're in luck. Some of the baddest organizers in the country in the room. So you see, Sister Bettina, you raise your hand. So you go see her. She'll tell you how to organize clergy, which are, and she's in the next workshop. But she'll tell, so she can tell you how to organize clergy, right? This is Rasheen right here. So one, so stand up. Rasheen's one of the young leaders to emerge out of Ferguson. This is Bishop John Selders. He founded Moral Mondays, Connecticut. So there are folks in the room who can show you how to do the work, and then, you know, Chris Crass might be the baddest white boy on the planet, and he can tell you how to talk to white folk.
Right on.
And then the other piece is that one of the things that we encountered in Ferguson is that there was not a nonprofit industrial complex, right? So there was not a lot of organizations, only two organized, there was only one main organization doing work in Ferguson proper, and that was the people doing the Show Me 15, and there was a little work being happening around municipal court reform. Am I right? So it wasn't like a lot. So a lot of these organizations that you've seen emerge, Hands Up United, Millennial Youth, mm-hmm. Millennial Activists United, are all new because there was no nonprofit industrial complex to tamper the social movement, right? So these young people that hit the street, right, and then began to organize themselves in their own forms, and then the more traditional organizations had to respond. And the way in which they've consistently had to respond is because they won't go home. Like they won't. You know, like Ferguson is the longest rebellion against police repression in U.S. history. Second only to the Montgomery bus boycott in terms of a civil rights piece, and it's like 9 months longer than the Selma campaign. And that's because young people, they won't, I mean, so we, for all of the nonprofits and the Don't Shoot Coalition, which is our major kind of infrastructure where all the kind of more traditional Jobs with Justice, Moore and the other organizations are who are doing a lot of the policy work, the only reason they're getting traction on the policy work because they won't go home. So the turn up is what they call it.
That's right.
So the young people are always in the street shutting shit down. And then the phones get to ringing. They'll be like, what can you do to get them out the street? I said, well, they don't listen to me. So I want them to go home too. But as long as they in the street, I'm in the street. And then the other piece is that, so one of the major criticisms that I've personally received is I won't criticize them publicly. Like, I refuse to do it, even when I think they're wrong. Now, they come over my house, I'm cussing them out. I'm talking bad to you, little ignorant. I'm talking bad to them. But in the street, and on television, they mine.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what they do. They belong to us.
That's right.
And so I would just want to say, what I would want to say to you is, in addition to being in contact with these great organizers who are doing the work, but also you can never devalue the turn up.
Amen.
People are like, so that means I'm here for a little while. We can shut some shit down.
Yeah, let's do it.
Right. And so I'm just saying, so you hit the street, you shut it down, and then everybody else got to respond.
Right.
And part of it, the truth be told, and this might be, I don't know white folks that well, but I can talk a little bit about black folk, is that a lot of us have just gotten comfortable. NAACP done got comfortable with the powers. Right? Now, the local chapters tend to be more radical. But a lot of times they're a little, and preachers, you know, I'm one. Sometimes I feel like I'm a missionary to Christianity trying to save it from itself. Is that, and so the issue is that as long as you hit the street and put the pressure on, everything else is going to, and don't you ever let anybody tell you that the turn up don't matter. That's what creates, King talked about social movements are like thermometers, I mean thermostats. They set political climate.
Yep.
Elections, public policy, legislation are thermometers. They measure political climate, right? Supreme Court is responding to queer folks showing their ass in the street for the past 20 years. That's what they're responding to, right? Even though it's symbolic, but the removal of the Confederate flag, right? You start seeing the removal of the federal flag immediately after people start spray painting Confederate monuments all over the country, and the first one was in St. Louis.
That's right.
Right? So in that sense, so the turn up. So I'm saying turn up and meet with these organizers. I'm sorry.
All right. No, okay. So here's the only thing. Some of the people on our panel actually have to do another workshop.
Okay.
So can everyone stand up for me? Just stand up, because we got to do something before we go.
All right, y'all, take hands.
Okay.
Take hands. We're gonna do a ritual of courage. This is a ritual of courage. This has become a movement ritual in the Black Lives Matter movement. It comes from Assata Shakur, political prisoner who helped escape prison because white anti-racist lesbians helped break her out of prison and escape safely to Cuba. Assata Shakur, her autobiography, Assata, I highly recommend it. So we're gonna do a call and response. And for all of you out there who are white, there's going to be a part at the end that's probably going to make you feel uncomfortable. But I invite you to lean into it and to think about, what do I really have
to lose,
but what also do I have to gain from liberation? So you might feel uncomfortable, but that's okay, because revolution can be uncomfortable, and this experience is part of a revolutionary process. Let's do it together.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to win.
We must love each other.
And support each other.
We must love and support each other.
We have nothing to lose but our chains. Louder. No, so we do it three times. You go louder and then louder again.
Yes.
Are you ready? Second time, must be louder.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to win.
It is our duty to win.
It is our duty. We must love and support each other.
We must love and support each other.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
Now close your eyes, and I need you to let the entire convention center hear you. Are you ready?
Let's feel it.
Feel it.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to win.
It is our duty to win.
We must love each other and support each other.
We must love each other and support each other.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
All right. So this is a part of a workshop track, so please continue. Mad love.
This workshop is part of a track, Faith, Race, and Justice. The next one at 3 is Multi-Faith Community Organizing and Black Lives Matter. After that, we have Showing Up in Ferguson, which will be right next door. The next one's here. And tomorrow, we have Chris Crass doing Collective Liberation and Kate Lauren and her friends doing Ending Mass Incarceration. We are building a movement. We are a coalition of UUs who have put this on together. So stick around.
Check out the book. It's in the back. There's more copies if it sells out. Oh, Asada. A-S-S-A-T-A. Asada. Yeah.
Got some energy up in here, I'll tell you what.
I know you. You look very familiar.
Chris, what's your phone number?
I gotta go do a session. Thank you.
Is your session next?
Yeah. No. It's with Kenny, this GA Young Adult Talk.
Are you talking?
There's like some other people talking.
Where is
it? I don't know. CRASS. No, crisscross.org.
I don't need to stand in front of you that way.
Yeah.